Good morning, this is Jane DeGrenier. Today is Sunday, February 8th, and I'm reading Globe Magazine, the February 8th, 2026 edition. 10 moments that defined the Patriots' culture-changing season. A coach's viral sideline run, a magical drive in Buffalo. This is how New England built a Super Bowl run, by Christopher Price. Every moment in the National Football League creates a ripple. Some make a barely perceptible splash. Others lead to seismic events for an organization. Their sum reveals the real character of a team. This holds true for the New England Patriots' improbable run to Super Bowl today. Moments big and small during Mike Vrabel's first year as head coach capture a team building the trust and chemistry that would catapult them from the bottom of the division to the brink of a seventh title. Here are the 10 moments on the field and beyond that have defined their remarkable season. 1. Preseason jolt. It was a beautiful night on August 8th, and good vibes were in abundance after the Patriots unveiled a statue of Tom Brady before the game. It was the first game, albeit a preseason contest, of Mike Vrabel's coaching career in New England. But it was Trayvon Henderson, the rookie running back, who stole the show. Henderson dropped a hammer by taking the opening kickoff back 100 yards for a touchdown. He was like a lightning bolt, quarterback Drake May said. He saw the crease and he was gone. The play was the first real indicator that the 2025 rookie class was a special group. Each of the 11 players drafted ended up playing in at least 3 regular season games, while several, including Will Campbell and Craig Woodson, would emerge as starters. Second big moment, family affair. On August 10th, local media members and their families were sitting down to a complimentary barbecue inside Gillette Stadium, a small token of appreciation from the team as the grind of the regular season drew closer. Mothers, fathers, partners, and children were all enjoying the afternoon. Roughly halfway through, Vrabel appeared at the door and started shaking hands, speaking with the reporters and their families. He asked children how long it was before school started and if they were going to be playing football that fall. He joked and smiled as he conversed with parents and partners. Yes, there would still be awkward silences during press conferences, and reporters would have tough questions to ask. But in that moment, the small gesture by the new coach spoke volumes about the new era dawning in Foxborough. Number 3, running mate. Miami had taken a 27-22 lead midway through the fourth quarter on the sweltering afternoon of September 14th. Despite a solid start for New England, the game looked to be headed the same direction as so many recent Pats-Dolphins games in South Florida over the last decade, with Miami finding a way to win, meaning an 0-2 start to the Vrabel era. But Antonio Gibson received the ensuing kickoff, found a seam, and sped down the sideline. By the time he hit midfield, there was his head coach on the sideline, sprinting next to him. Vrabel gamely tried to keep up with Gibson for roughly 10 yards, but the running back soon pulled away. The mad dash would go viral and further endear Vrabel to his players and provide the enduring image for his first win as the head coach. "If he was keeping up with me, I have to run faster," Gibson joked. "I heard he almost caught me." 4. T. Strong. Defensive coordinator Terrell Williams had been away from the team for stretches since the spring, and on September 26, we learned more about the medical issue keeping him out. During his Friday press conference, Vrabel announced that Williams had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. "You know how much Terrell means to me personally and to the people of this football team," said Vrabel, who has developed a deep relationship with Williams since their time together on the Tennessee Titans, when Williams was a member of Vrabel's coaching staff. Zach Cure, the inside linebacker coach, was stepped in as interim defensive player caller, but Williams has remained a regular visitor at Gillette, and the team has rallied around him donning T-Strong shirts during warm-ups after the announcement. Vrabel was honored with the coach with a T-Strong message on his game day vest throughout the season. "My prayers go out to Williams for real, because he's a good coach." And he believed in all of us, said safety Jalen Hawkins. He's got his kids. That's somebody that nobody should go through. Number five, May's Day. There were just over 2 minutes remaining. The Bills had erased a 10-point fourth-quarter deficit to tie the October 5th game at 20. The Buffalo faithful were yowling into the Western New York night, practically shaking the foundation of Highmark Stadium. That's when Drake May stepped into the huddle with the Patriots at their 30-yard line and started the drive of his professional career. The series was highlighted by a 12-yard completion to wide receiver Stephon Diggs, delivered as the quarterback was being hauled to the ground. He turned an 8-yard loss to a 12-yard gain, marveled Vrabel. Andy Borgalis drilled the game-winning field goal from 19 yards to provide the difference in the 23-20 win. May, almost perfect in the second half, finished 22 for 30 for 273 yards and outdueled Buffalo quarterback Josh Allen, the reigning MVP. 2-minute drive to win it, May said afterward. That's what you want. Number six, Henderson again. The preseason touchdown wasn't Trayvon Henderson's only memorable run. During the final moments of a steamy November 9th game in Tampa Bay, the Patriots were clinging to a 21-16 lead, looking to run out the clock. Taking a pitch from May, Henderson broke loose and headed down the sideline. But there was a moment of confusion. Should he score or sit down before the end zone, killing more clock and effectively ending the game? He turned to the sideline for a sign. I've seen some people saying go down, some people saying to score. It was mixed, the rookie said sheepishly. I was trying to find one of the coaches, but it was just happening so fast. Henderson opted for the end zone en route to a 28-23 win. The moment of indecision turned into an internet meme and another reminder of the transformative impact that the rookie class would have on the 2025 roster. Number seven, that's for you, Lonnie. Linebacker Jelani Tavai wasn't with the team in the days before the November 23rd game in Cincinnati. Vrabel told reporters he was out for personal reasons. During the game, tight end Hunter Henry scored a touchdown. When the cameras found him, he hollered, "That's for you, Laney." After the 26-20 win, teammates talked about FaceTiming Tavai and wanting to win on his behalf. A couple of weeks later, the reasons behind his absence were revealed. Tavani's partner, Kalai Mao, shared on social media that she experienced a stillbirth at 6 months pregnant while in a medically induced coma due to what she described as a rare blood infection. The team closed ranks around Tavai and his family. The tragedy helped cement an already tight bond in the locker room. My thoughts are with Jelani and what he's going through. I love Jelani, May said after the win in Cincinnati. That's what's cool about this game. It's such a team sport. Guys rally around each other and play for one another. Number eight, reality check. The matchup on December 14th was supposed to mark a changing of the guard in the AFC East. A hard-charging New England team, which had won 10 straight games, was ready to assume the throne from the Bills, who had won the division for 5 straight years. But Bills quarterback Josh Allen didn't allow that to happen, not on that day at least, orchestrating a comeback from a 17-point halftime deficit on the way to a 35-31 win. A group of Buffalo players taunted New England fans on their way off the field, waving goodbye as they danced down the tunnel on the way to the locker room. The loss stung for New England, but served as a teachable moment. While they were doing a lot of things right, they still needed to find another gear if they were going to be able to compete with the elites in the AFC. This is definitely a reality check, Henry said after the loss. We've got to get a lot better fast. The Patriots would not drop another game on their way to the Super Bowl. Number nine, Holland's swagger. Mac Hollins was back. The veteran receiver, who had been out for 4 weeks with an abdomen injury, walked into Denver's Empower Field at Mile High for the AFC Championship game on January 25th, ready to roll, wearing a leather vest and clinking beer bottles together. "Warriors, come out to play," he chirped. using the line as a nod to the iconic 1979 film The Warriors. An example of Holland's occasional flair for the dramatic, it showed the Patriots were bent on earning their Road Warriors moniker after going undefeated away from home over the course of the season. It was also a reminder that while the team boasts marquee talent, it also has complementary pieces, glue guys such as Hollins, who execute their roles at a high level. In the end, the receiver had a pair of catches during a snowy nail-biter in Denver, but it was his infectious energy that made the difference, helping power the Patriots to the Super Bowl. And number 10, new era, new slogan. Under Bill Belichick, the Patriots specialized in Super Bowls and inspirational phrases. Do your job, no days off, ignore the noise, we're on to Cincinnati. Vrabel, who played for 8 seasons under Belichick in New England, has similar philosophies as his former coach. But his team has developed some catchphrases of its own. No naps is a Vrabel favorite, a way of reminding players not to get complacent. Don't switch the macaroni and cheese, caught on in the locker room, as a way of encouraging players not to change their approach and to stay consistent from week to week. One rallying cry gained steam in the days after the November trade deadline, when New England decided to stand pat and not make a move. We all we got, we all we need. In a pregame speech before the win in Buffalo, Diggs, the first one to use the phrase, according to teammates, was caught on camera offering a slightly more profane version. It gained momentum, an acknowledgement of the trust generated in the locker room. Players have sported custom hoodies with the slogan, and fans feature it on signs at games. There have been other milestones, of course, including May's key block on a 65-yard touchdown run by Henderson during the loss to the Bills, and two Marcus Jones punt returns for scores. Ultimately, all these moments together show a team evolving beyond what many expected. Continue to believe in your brother. Have faith in your brother and support one another, said linebacker Kalavon Chaisson of the All We Got mantra. This bond, this chemistry, can take us much farther than we can expect. Now the world is about to find out just how far they'll go. Up front, Why Black Women Are Moving Abroad by Dolores Edwards. Growing up, it was always an adventure to leave my Bronx neighborhood, driving hundreds of miles to see relatives down south and experience a different region of the United States. Hopping on a plane to exotic locales didn't make our nightly dinner table conversations. It existed only in my imagination. When I got the chance to travel as an adult, I jetted off to as many Caribbean islands as I could. It got me thinking, could I live someplace like this? Years passed and the idea of living on an island drifted away like an outgoing tide. But in online communities, Black women speak openly about living in another country, on another continent, and images of them doing exactly that fill social media. Virtual conferences, YouTube channels, and podcasts such as Exodus Summit, Blakesit Global, and Flourish the Foreign provide information and discussions with Black women expats who share their experiences living abroad. In their 20s to 60s and beyond, these women share the pros and cons of unapologetically packing their bags and crossing continents and time zones to begin a new season of their lives, temporarily or permanently outside the United States. They're empty nesters, singled, married, divorced, widowed, educated, and educators, executives, retirees, ex-military, coaches, and entrepreneurs. For them, moving abroad has become, well, a movement. The exact number of Americans living abroad is unknown. The Association of Americans Resident Overseas estimates it's over 5 million. The U.S. State Department announced in 2023 it would stop providing estimates due to a lack of accurate data. Before moving to Portugal in August of 23, Nicole Barrett lived in Boston and nearby communities for almost 30 years. She treasures her memories of Newbury Street, Boylston Street, time on the Vineyard, and lobster rolls at the Barking Crab. but in 2017, she started thinking of leaving the United States. The reason expats give for departing are as varied as the people going, but common threads emerge. Some simply have a strong desire to experience living in another country. Some are uneasy about the current political climate. Some wish to simply feel safer and stop being othered. I'm reminded of writers James Baldwin, Richard Wright, and others who expatriated to France in the 1940s to fulfill their creative expression, unburdened by the weight of racism in America. The year of return in 2019 saw an estimated 1,500 African Americans move to Ghana. The initiative marked 400 years since the first enslaved Africans arrived on Virginia's shores. The pursuit of physical and emotional safety drives some black women with children, such as Barrett, to leave. A racial profiling incident aimed at her son on a high school trip, and the anxiety attack by a child she considered almost a foster son, which he experienced after George Floyd's murder, factored into her decision. For black mothers, the deaths of black children, including Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and others, adds urgency. Vice President Kamala Harris's 24% presidential candidacy was a defining moment for many black women to be heard. 92% supported her, according to a Washington Post exit poll. Her loss runs deep. Health is a driver, too. The impact of chronic work stress is documented and hard to overlook. The deaths of in 2023 of two college presidents led to speculation that the impact of chronic work stress, racism, and sexism they experienced in their professional lives as black women in top leadership roles may have been a contributor. The following year, a Lincoln University administrator took her own life after complaining about a toxic work environment and harassment. Federal budget cuts and DOGE changes had been a source of stress for a 25-year veteran of the Social Security Administration who died at her desk last February, her sister said. If dealing with microaggressions, harassment, and having to constantly prove they're qualified isn't enough, black women also face retaliation or dismissal if they complain. Unemployment for this demographic soared to 7.8% in December of 25. Versus 4.4% for all workers nationwide, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Black women earn 64.4% for every dollar earned by white men, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Black women are tired. Forever the fixers who are passed over and pushed aside, black women seek community and cultural freedom that accepts who they are. They want room to breathe. Barrett, formerly an executive for Sandals Resorts, fell in love with Portugal while there on a work trip. She leaned into her travel expertise to start the Saudale Life, a business offering travel and wine experiences. Moving abroad requires adjusting a bureaucratic process, she says, but she's found freedom from the constant stress, code switching, and armor black women wear in the United States. Since 2020, the Exodus Summit has been a source for black women to gather information to plan their expat lives. Last fall, on my second visit to its paid virtual summit, I noticed an increase in attendance and energy. The speakers discussed teaching, accounting, and project management, positions offering clarity about employment overseas. Sharing a moment of sisterhood, more than 2,500 black women came together for a common purpose. As images of lush greenery, blue water, and cobblestone streets flood my mind, I know that living abroad doesn't mean racism is no longer an issue. It persists all over the world, yet black women such as Charlotte Van Horn, CEO of Black Expats in Panama, have found joy and fulfillment living in communities they are helping to build. Black women are looking for places where the color of their skin is not a debate, a talking point, or classification. Sharing a collective identity, commonality, and heritage is the inclusiveness they welcome. Island living sounds idyllic and holds a different meaning than in my earlier days of island-hopping vacations. Knowing your reasons why is a crucial step in the process. The big day, when your honeymoon includes studying for finals. Frenry and Bonnard married at the Boston Public Library, followed by a small Back Bay dinner. Then they hit the books. By Rachel Kim Raxka. Long before Frenry and Bonnard became an official couple, he gave her a ring. It was June 2024, and the two were still relative strangers. Bonnard was a lodger in the attached unit Frenry's mother rented out in their Mattapan home. He had recently moved to the Boston area from Cayes-Jacmel, Haiti, where he was a physician to prepare to test for his recertification and apply for residencies. Frenry had been volunteered by her mother to drive the new neighbor to the mall to buy clothes for a party hosted by her godparents. They had only met in passing, and while both insist it was just friendly, Frenry's eyes were drawn to the gold band on his right ring finger. "Are you married?" she asked. Bonnard insisted he was not. "It was for fashion," he explained, "and it was on the wrong hand, on his left hand, where a wedding band would be. He wore two more rings. As a bassist, he likes that the metal can catch light when he plays." When Frenry wasn't convinced, he took the ring off and handed it to her to keep as proof. She thinks she drew it away, calling it bad luck. I didn't know if another girl gave it to him. Maybe he was married, or maybe I was very guarded at the time. But I was like, no, I don't know who this dude is, she remembers. He's just a random man who gave me a ring. Fenry's family loves to entertain. Their parties are full of good music, great lasagna, and assigned family roles. The one who gets everyone on the dance floor, the one who mans the speaker, and DJs. For Bonnard, who is naturally shy, it was his first U.S. party ever, says Frenry. "Give me a drink," and we danced for a couple of minutes, and after that, I went back in my corner. Fenry's mother pulled her aside. "I heard you have a new boyfriend." When she denied the claim, her mom continued that her source had a prediction. He said, "You guys are going to be together for a long time." Bonnard's interest was piqued, but after his Instagram DM and WhatsApp message went unanswered, he deleted her newly acquired phone number. "She was traveling for work at the time, and I don't check my DMs," Frenry explains. Meanwhile, she remembers watching Bonnard from the window with her mom. He would sit on a bench outside their house, surrounded by textbooks, as he studied for the United States medical licensing exam until 1 or 2 a.m. "It was summer, and I'm Haitian. I like studying outside," Bonnard says. When they finally coordinated a first date that July, Frenry invited four female family members along. Her longtime boyfriend had passed away a few years earlier, and she was cautious about dating and wary of his intentions. Based on their shared cultural background, Frenry, who is Haitian-American, was concerned he wouldn't support her ambitions to complete her Ph.D. "I had sort of this image in my mind of a stereotypical Haitian man," she says. When a group arrived for what he thought was a date, Bonnard was taken aback, and they both were surprised that he recognized everyone. She didn't realize that all the people she invited with her for that first date, I had already knew all of them from back in Haiti, he says. We lived in the same town. Frenry has spent most of her life in the United States, but she was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where her grandparents' home had been a 5-minute walk from Bonnard's parents' house, they'd later discover. She was even more surprised when Bonnard and her cousin seamlessly took to the dance floor. "We were in the same salsa course in Jacmel," Bonnard says with a laugh. "He danced with everyone in their group that night except Frenry, and I loved dancing," she says. "I was so mad," he says, of the turn of events. "So it was like, okay, you're going to be rude, I'm going to be ruder." While the night didn't go as planned, and they laugh about it now, they continue to orbit one another, occasionally stopping to chat. One day, Bonnard caught Frenry in a bad mood. She unloaded her woes, and he sat and listened. As they approached the four-hour mark, he had begun to open up. 2. They shared their dreams, their childhoods. Bonnard explained his plans to become a doctor in the States and the arduous journey for a foreign-trained physician, from retesting in English to completing additional residencies. I knew this was going to be a tough process, he says. New language, new culture, new everything. And the first person who made me feel very confident about that dream was her. Because I talked to her about my plan, she said, okay, you can make it happen. I have friends who already did that. I know it's not going to be easy. She offered to make introductions for him and shared ways he could feel motivated and focused. She deferred her acceptance into the University of Michigan's joint PhD in English and Women's and Gender Studies, but planned to attend the following year. They could study together. I started to see him differently, she says, to see his plans and the way that his mind worked and his character. And after that, we became flirtatious friends. Then, after her mother's Thanksgiving dinner, they shared a first kiss. And about a year later, Bonnard proposed on November 8, 2025, with a surprise party at a Pier Space rental in Brockton with 30 members of their families present. He'd prepared by asking the permission of her mother, her aunt, and her godfather, whom Fenry considers the patriarch of their family. They would later ask him to officiate their wedding, a clever way to sneak an extra family member into the Boston Public Library's 12-guest max for its coveted one-hour wedding package. Fenry, now 24, and Bonnard, 31, wed on December 8th at the library. The ceremony was performed in Haitian Creole so that family members who had rented a hall in Haiti and dressed up for the occasion could zoom in. There were speeches made, there was music, says Bonnard. I was like, y'all are having a great time. The newlyweds toasted their big day with a dinner for 20 at Willow and Ivy in the Back Bay. Bonnard's sister, who lives in France, gifted the couple a getaway at a nearby hotel after hearing they hadn't planned a honeymoon. We're deep in finals, Fenry remembers explaining. It's non-refundable, she had replied. After the wedding, they checked in with all their textbooks and study materials, and wearing the new wedding rings that neither plans to throw away. Look who's still getting affirmative action. A 2023 Supreme Court decision barred colleges from considering race in admissions. What has resulted is anything but unbiased. By Kara Miller. Getting into college has never, ever been purely meritocratic. Indeed, much of the current admissions process, the essay, the recommendations, the extracurriculars, was specifically designed to curb the number of Jewish students in elite schools. In the early 1920s, Harvard President A. Lawrence Lowell debated how to reduce the number of Jews at the university, urging particularly rigorous criteria for the Hebrew race. Decades later, debates over admitting women into Ivy League schools were equally fierce. Oh, save us, the Yale Daily News wrote in 1956, from the giggling crowds, the domestic lecture, and the home economics classes of a female infiltration. Yale did not admit its first female students until the fall of 1969. But over time, many selective schools have sought to become more equitable, however they define that, and more representative of America. For much of the last 60 years, the nation's leaders have tried to move in a similar direction. In 1961, shortly after he was inaugurated, President John F. Kennedy signed an executive order, coining the term affirmative action. He and Vice President Lyndon Johnson hoped to take stronger action against government contractors who discriminated on the basis of race. In 1969, President Richard Nixon said his goal for contractors was to show affirmative action to meet the goals of increasing minority employment. In higher education, affirmative action eventually became the norm for many schools. Then, in 2022, there was an earthquake. Natasha Waraku, a sociology professor at Tufts, was wrapping up a book called Is Affirmative Action Fair? When the Supreme Court decided to revisit the issue. The case, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, alleged that the school had spent years unfairly discriminating against Asian applicants, rating them lower on personal qualities than both white students and non-Asian students of color. Court filings revealed that Harvard had written internal reports on Asian applicants that, as Harvard Magazine has noted, were circulated among Harvard's top administrators and concluded the school's admissions practices have negative effects on Asian American applicants to the college. The rejected applicants were represented by Edward Bloom, a conservative activist who was recalled the anti-Semitism his family experienced when he was growing up. It turns out that the suspicions of Asian American alumni students and applicants were right all along, SFFA argued. Harvard today engages in the same kind of discrimination and stereotyping that it used to justify quotas on Jewish applicants in the 1920s and 1930s. In her book, Weriku argues that affirmative action should not be judged on an individual level, but on an institutional level. In essence, admissions becomes a way for universities to fulfill their missions, which are most often related to contributing to our shared social world. And the Supreme Court had long backed affirmative action. So initially, Weriku thought it wouldn't take up the SFFA case, since in her mind there was nothing new to consider. But in the fall of 2022, it did. This is going to be big, Weriku thought. And it probably is not going to go well if you believe in race-conscious admissions, as I do. The Supreme Court announces its rulings on Thursdays in June, and Weriku waited through four Thursdays in the spring of 23 without any word on the affirmative action case. When it finally came on the fifth Thursday, the verdict was what she had thought and feared. But of course, the real impact was yet to come. How would admissions offices, especially at highly selective schools, change who they admitted? Weriku knew it would take years for the data to roll in. 2.5 years later, some of it has. At many highly selective institutions, black enrollment has plummeted. For data on selective New England colleges, see the chart on the next page. At Amherst, Cornell, and Wellesley, for example, the number of black students has declined more than 30% from years just prior to the Supreme Court ruling. Hispanic enrollment is more complicated. It has decreased at some schools, MIT, but increased at others, Dartmouth. Asian enrollment has been similarly mixed, increasing at some selective institutions, Columbia, while decreasing at others, Duke. White enrollment, at least at New England schools, is a similarly complex picture. We are seeing a resegregation of higher education, says Anthony Abram Jack, the faculty director of the Newberry Center at Boston University's Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Though the Supreme Court case said nothing about on-campus programs to support students of color, Jack believes that there has been a removal of resources on the campuses that still do have black students. Many schools are simply obeying in advance or doing away with things because they never wanted to do it in the first place. When Angel Perez was the vice president for enrollment and student success at Trinity College in Connecticut from 2015 to 2020, he had access to a student's race and demographics, he notes. And so we were able to take race into consideration as we thought about diversifying our class. Now, what's particularly challenging, Perez says, is that the majority of those institutions would still tell you today that they certainly believe that having a diverse student body is a part of their values, a part of their mission. And so achieving that goal has become a lot more challenging. But though race can no longer be considered as part of a student's application, other sorts of admission preferences march on, unaffected by the Supreme Court's ruling. These preferences create a powerful incentive system that shapes young people's lives, especially in affluent areas. Weriku, whose most recent book is Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream, in suburban schools has written about the enormous amount of money many families spend on the quest for extracurricular excellence. She says that highly selective colleges shouldn't pretend they are fair and everybody has an equal chance to get in here, which is clearly not the case. In fact, if you are looking to get a leg up in the admissions process, there are lots of ways to tilt the playing field in your favor. Let's explore the options. Be great at sports. Recruited athletes have, for a long time and still remain, in a totally different pool than the rest of an institution's applicants, says Ami Harwood, executive director of the Association of College Counselors in Independent Schools. She says that coaches' priorities are driven by ever-changing dynamics. Do you need a goalkeeper this year for women's soccer? Do you need a defensive specialist for men's volleyball? In upper-middle-class towns, you'll find large numbers of students pouring time and money into crew, squash, fencing, and whatever else they think might give them an edge. These sports are particularly alluring because, unlike track and basketball, which require little specialized equipment and are therefore available to millions of students, sports with expensive equipment and hard-to-find coaching expertise are likely to be available only to a wealthy few. Have we gotten out of hand with how much attention we pay in this country to sports and connect it to higher education, says Perez, who is now CEO of the National Association for College Admission Counseling. I think we need to do a lot of soul searching. I still have the trauma of being an admissions dean, he says. I had so many challenges with the coaches who wanted me to take this kid and the development office who wanted me to take that kid. If anything drove home the special treatment that admissions offices gives athletes, it was the Varsity Blues scandal, which broke in Boston in 2019. The multi-year saga, which ensnared actress Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, along with a bunch of non-famous people, centered around a private college counselor who, among other things, bribed coaches and college officials to accept his clients' children as recruited athletes. But even when the admissions process is untainted by scandal, the privilege given to athletes can still feel scandalous. In part, that's because privileging great athletes can amount to privileging wealth. I know how expensive it is to hire coaches, says Perez, and to be trained in some of these sports, you have to get in them when you're 5 or 6 years old. Be rich. The sports advantage dovetails nicely with this next advantage. If you're looking to get a major leg up in the college admissions process, being rich is enormously helpful. And that enormousness is hard to overstate. The Harvard-based nonprofit Opportunity Insights notes that if you compare kids whose parents earn in the top 1% of Americans with kids whose parents earn in the bottom 20%, the kids at the top are a whopping 77 times more likely to attend elite colleges and universities. In 2017, when a group of economists led by Raj Chetty, then at Stanford, now at Harvard, dug into these statistics, they found that lots of competitive schools, including Duke, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Brown, and Dartmouth, had more kids from the top 1% of the income distribution than from the bottom 50%. Take a minute to wrap your head around that. Of course, money confers advantages in a variety of ways. If your family can donate large sums, a development case in admissions lingo, the college can plow that money into endowed professorships, building maintenance, or even scholarships for needy students. If you fall in the development category, count yourself very, very lucky. But few rich people are that rich. So money mostly tends to be helpful in burnishing a student's resume, paying for sports camps, math tutoring, SAT prep. Wuraku found that private college counselors who can offer advice and massage a resume have become popular in affluent communities. If you play the right sports, if you hire the right tutors or hire the right people to create your application, your curated profile helps you get in, says Jack of the Newberry Center. Generational wealth, he argues, makes affording a $5,000 to $10,000 coach for college possible. Harward notes that being a legacy, the child or grandchild of someone who attended the school, might be helpful, but legacy helps more when there's money tied to it. Someone who thinks my $100 a year donation is going to get my child into my alma mater, it never really worked that way, even without the potential for huge giving, she says. The admissions office might still flag a legacy application as context for the applicant, yet race cannot be similarly considered as contextual information. Be a man. 20 years ago, Jennifer Dolahunty apologized in a New York Times op-ed to the legions of girls she had rejected as dean of admissions and financial aid at Kenyon College in Ohio. That year, 2006, her daughter Madeline got waitlisted at one of the schools she had applied to, and as Dolahunty told me, the professional became personal. At Kenyon, Dolahunty spent her days waitlisting what I call a sea of perfect Emilys. All these young women who were so accomplished, and yet we had to keep our eye on diversity of all kinds, right? Dolahunty was acutely aware that neither men or women want to attend a gender imbalanced school. And there's a tipping point, she says, where you lose your marketability as a college. But to maintain a gender-balanced class at Kenyon, Dolahunty had to reject lots of high-achieving women, and she was mad about it. I mean, I was one of those Emilys. In the last 20 years, the application imbalance has only gotten more pronounced. In 2024, according to the Washington Post, Brown University fielded almost twice as many female applicants as males, though it's important to note that there are nearly even numbers of men and women at Brown. Young women have been outperforming young men on test scores and things that are related to admissions for more than a generation, says Jack. But colleges have taken an affirmative step to balance off the gender ratio. This has been a slow-moving tsunami. In 1970, amongst full-time college students, there were about 40% more men than women. By 2025, the numbers had flipped dramatically, with about 30% more women than men attending college full-time. Dolahunty says the pandemic took a trend and supercharged it. In the space of just a few decades, girls and women have not just caught up with the boys and men in the classroom, writes Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men and a senior fellow at Brookings. They have blown right past them. That's true in elementary school, it's true in high school, and it's true in college. As a former dean, this is so hard, Perez says, because I would get beat up every year by the community. Why can't you bring us a more balanced class? And every year we ended up with more and more women, even though we were trying to admit as many men as possible. Perez says he worries the problem will get worse. I talk to admission deans every day who say no matter how hard I try, the gender balance just never comes in the way we want it to on the campus. And so there are campuses that are now approaching 70-80% female. They're looking internally and saying we want to shift this, but the demographics are not working on our side. The girls have to be not just an ounce better, Dolahunty says. They have to be a pound better. Which brings us back to affirmative action and the idea that it's wrong to favor some groups of people over others. That may be. There are compelling arguments to be made for both for and against affirmative action. But the notion that the current college process is free of preferences is absurd. Affirmative action implies that there is this so-called meritocracy that doesn't exist and never did, says Harward. She argues that it's wrong to remove race-conscious admission from the tools that a vice president for enrollment can use in crafting a class, but to leave athletic recruiting development and fundraising legacy status as well as trying to balance the class for gender. I actually probably have a really unpopular opinion about this, says Perez. I believe that the beauty of higher education is its diversity and how the institution decides to enroll its class. How that institution uses its admissions process to meet the goals of the mission should be up to them. It should not be up to the federal government. Waraku thinks that as recently as a decade ago, most people thought of college admissions as mostly fair, mostly a meritocracy. And the kids who work the hardest are on the quote-unquote smartest are the ones who are going to be chosen. But, she notes, Varsity Blues was a lesson in how the system could be gamed and how too often academics play second or third fiddle. States such as California began to sour on colleges, giving preference to the children of alumni. It remains the only state that has banned the practice for private schools as of last September. In 2024, a bill was introduced in Massachusetts to ban legacy admissions. It is still being considered, and girls' distinct disadvantages in admissions have started to attract more attention. Waraku says this has all disrupted the respect or the good faith that people had in higher education. Perhaps, if there is some value in that mistrust, it's this. As long as higher education has existed, the admissions process has only ever been partly about merit. In truth, it's about so many other factors, some of which students can control and many which they can't. We have to stop believing and then stop telling kids that this is a measure of your self-worth, Waraku says, and colleges, too, need to start pretending that this is a system in which we select the best of the best. Stop advertising the admit rates. Why are you proud that you're rejecting all of these amazing people? First blush. Brown furniture against walls the color of calamine lotion suddenly feels fresh, by Marnie Elise Katz. As a major throughway to the playroom, the former living space in this 1800s farmhouse in Weston needed to be sturdy and pulled together. We used a performance velvet on the sofa, treated the chair fabric, and selected a durable vintage rug so the room isn't off limits for their three young sons, Lindsay Adiputi, founder of LEB Interiors, says. The second challenge, giving the wife the pinks and purples she loves without the scheme skewing too feminine for a house full of boys. We chose an earthy pink paint that's a sophisticated neutral, then introduced more masculine touches, Adiputu says. Armchairs, walls, drapery fabrics, painting, dark stained tables, and a muted greens and pinks of a vintage rug. Checking the box. Love letters. We're aligned in many ways, but I'm conflicted about proposing. Question? I'm 40, and my girlfriend is a few years younger. We've been dating for about a year and recently moved in together. Overall, our relationship is strong and healthy. We communicate well, we're aligned on our life goals, and we both want a family. By all practical measures, everything seems to be moving in the right direction. Recently, I started talking to my family about proposing to her 5 or 6 months from now. What surprised me was my emotional reaction. I wasn't excited or joyful. It wasn't panic exactly, but it also wasn't happiness. When I tried to understand where that feeling was coming from, I couldn't pinpoint a clear reason. When I asked my family for input or perspective, the response was mostly, "Do what you want, I guess," which left me feeling more alone in sorting this out. I care deeply about her and our future, which makes me wonder whether these feelings stem from my stage in life, a fear of change or responsibility, or a sign that I should slow down and reflect more before taking the next step. How do I distinguish between natural apprehension and a deeper hesitation that shouldn't be ignored? And how much excitement is enough when making a decision as big as marriage? Signed, reflecting. My first thought, talk to a therapist, is the answer from Meredith. Not because anything sounds wrong or troubling, but because you seem to need a place where you can process feelings. My second thought, you're 40 and on a schedule. You know what you want, but maybe the efficiency of this relationship makes the engagement seem less romantic. I do hope you can take a beat to enjoy what you have. If every step has felt like a way to get to kids by 42, please take some months to simply enjoy living together. Another point to consider when it comes to excitement, many of us grew up watching TV shows about people who have big emotional engagements. I held my heart when I watched Jim propose to Pam on The Office. That fictional proposal seemed epic because those characters had to sort out major conflicts for many seasons before we got to see them happy. But you're not a TV character. You're a real person who wants to marry your significant other. Maybe this uncomfortable feeling is about your family. Perhaps it felt anticlimactic to tell them. Do what you want, I guess, isn't the most loving and supportive sentiment. Just something to consider. Meredith. Readers respond, I think what you are feeling is the uncertainty that comes with not knowing what it's like to live with her long term. You're still in the honeymoon phase. Wait until you've lived together for a year before deciding if you want to propose. Seen it too. DDL314 writes, I do think it's worth exploring with a therapist, whether you're just not ready or if this isn't the relationship for you. The way you describe it comes across as, I'm 40 and think I should settle down and this will do. Meredith Goldstein wants your letters. Send your relationship quandaries and questions to loveletters@globe.com. Listen to the new season of Love Letters wherever you get your podcasts. Skating Backward by Patricia Ryburn. When you grow up in New England, certain winter skills learned as a kid stay with you forever. Holding the end of your sweater sleeve before sliding your arm into a coat, tucking your mitten inside the wristband of that coat, packing a tight snowball, ice skating. As the youngest in our family of six in a Franklin neighborhood with an even larger households nearby, I learned to lace up my skates and glide onto the ice almost mostly by watching the older kids. I got the hang of keeping my balance and smoothly pushing off in an undeveloped area we call the brook, now referred to as wetlands or a swamp. In the spring and early summer, I'd spend hours on the muddy bank scooping up pollywogs in my hands and exploring the woodsy area along its edges. In the winter, it was comforting to know that this frozen world, within sight and yelling distance of my home, should anyone break through the ice, was barely waist-deep. The skating surface was fairly small and further limited by tufts of wild grass, convenient little islands for my child-sized body. There I could fling myself down in relative comfort to rest or land safely before falling forward and risking injury on the unforgiving ice. Over my cotton socks, I learned to wear a second pair of wool, which I stored inside the skates and to wipe the blades dry before putting on the rubber guards. Then I'd carefully pull the laces through the eyelets, knotting them together at the ends before slinging them around my neck. I learned to skate backward, a thrill, and I walked home with a swagger as the skates bumped against my thighs, my cheeks burning bright from the chill and exertion. I was a cowgirl toting a lasso, a mountain climber with coiled rope, a warrior with spear and shield bringing home the goods. My husband and I are fortunate to live on a small body of water in Canton, where perfect weather conditions will sometimes combine to provide an outdoor playground for skaters and ice fishermen alike. It's more than waist-deep, and the surface is unbroken by tufts of wetland grass. But those early days come to mind as I experience the still-thrilling freeing sensation of skating across smooth ice, the sun directly overhead, and the birds chirping as if cheering me on. Our two sons learned to skate here in the time-honored tradition of gripping a lawn chair or plastic milk crate before them. These days, our granddaughters mirrored those early efforts, sporting pink snowsuits and white figure skates and marking their progress by staying upright. But I see them twirling into their future. Surrounded by many neighbors whose generational roots here run deeper than our mere four decades, I'm grateful to live in this close-knit community. Check on the cats while you're away. Got you? Ride to the airport shuttle. Ditto. They say you choose your friends, but not your family. After four decades of living in this quiet area fringed by woods and centered on water, the demarcation line has blurred. Our friends, our family. On the ice, I watch as a fisherman pulls a pickerel from an ice-encrusted hole, then ask him if he can tell how thick the ice is by looking from above. He points to a perfectly square gray-blue block of ice resting on the surface and answers, 14 inches. Apparently, another neighbor used a chainsaw to extract that block and a few more, using them to mark the four rink corners for an impromptu hockey game, or to provide an icy seat for a small child. Looking out the window at the changing activity on the ice over the afternoon, I consider the life lessons learned in my many years of New England pond skating. They're deceptively simple. Strap yourself in, look to others for help, practice balance. When you fall, get up and go again, and when you become somewhat competent, try adding a little grace. That's all for the Globe today. Have a great week.